Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll. And today it's all about the legendary, maybe the biggest legend in pro wrestling history, Andre the Giant. Dave Meltzer from Wrestling Observer and author Pat LaPrade, who just released his new book, The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant, are both on the show to talk about Andre and his massive career. The book's a fascinating read. You can get it on Amazon or wherever you buy books. Pat talked to everybody and has so many great stories about Andre's life and career. We're going to talk all about them, from Andre's early work in Japan to his relationships with both Vince McMahon Sr. and, of course, Vince McMahon Jr., although he hates to be called Jr., to his legendary feud with Hulk Hogan. You'll also hear about the disease that caused Andre's giantism and why he never did anything about it. Andre's story is coming up huge very, very soon. And so is the Saturday special. I'm going to be telling more stories on my own and answering all your questions. So come hang out with me this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on Facebook Live and my official YouTube channel. Bring your bevy. Bring your song suggestion for the sing-along. It's the Saturday Night Special number 15. Wow, it's been 15 already. This Saturday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, on my official YouTube channel and Facebook Live. So go check that out and get ready to check out the eighth wonder of the world, the true story of Andre the Giant, with Pat LaPrade and Dave Meltzer, starting now on Talk is Jericho.
So a new book is coming out right now, and it's a perfect time to be reading books now that we're all kind of at home and looking for things to do. And one of the most interesting characters in the history of pro wrestling has to be Andre the Giant. And the book is called The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant by Pat LaPrade, who's joining us along with expert of all things wrestling, Dave Meltzer. And Pat, I guess, first of all, when you talk about the history of wrestling, the two names that still stand out to this day are Hulk Hogan and, of course, Andre the Giant. Everybody knows those two names, even now, 30-odd years after Andre's death. Is that one of the reasons why you wanted to kind of explore his life a little bit more?
Yeah, well, I mean, Andre was a name that resonated to me since my childhood, right? Because, you know, I was born in 76. I first went to my first pro wrestling show at 6 years old. So international wrestling here in Montreal was really big. And Andre was still working for them when I started watching wrestling. And then I switched to WWF, and he was a big part of them as well. You know, I must have rented WrestleMania 3 on VHS at least 10 times when I was a kid. So, I mean, you know, having ridden both on Montreal territory and on Mad Dog Deschamps, and being part of the HBO documentary as film producer, it felt right, you know, that our next subject would be Andre the Giant.
Andre's one of those guys that there's so many tales about him and so many, you know, and when watching that HBO documentary, I thought it was really well done, but definitely one of the most storied characters in the history of the business. Don't you agree, Dave?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's from every aspect of Andre, because, you know, Andre himself and publicists and everything like that, they created this storyline of the giant lumberjack moving a redwood tree. From day one, everything about Andre was a myth, and he played into it really well. The thing that about the book that fascinated me so much is that the actual depth and you know, story of Andre Roussimoff, the person, is actually a lot more interesting when you look at it than, you know, the lumberjack, the Paul Bunyan myths that surrounded Andre. But, I mean, as far as, like, you know, I mean, I would have to say that he was the most famous wrestler in the world for a long period of time, you know, probably until Hulk Hogan, and they were synonymous with each other for a long period of time. You know, and again, all over the world, you know, everyone knew Andre the Giant.
It's interesting, though, like nowadays, like in 2020, we have Paul White, and you have, I mean, we had the Giant Gonzalez, and you know, there's a lot of legit, I mean, Dalip Singh, it seems like it was, Giants weren't as as prevalent, shall we say, in the 60s and 70s to where Andre really stood out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the things, because before, in the early 60s, you had when Giant Baba toured the United States, and he was very tall. He was probably 6'8". Mm-hmm. And he was a big attraction before Andre. And then after that, like, the big touring attraction was Haystacks Calhoun at 600 pounds. But Andre was so much more physically impressive than both of those guys. And I think, you know, part of it was that, you know, you didn't have a whole lot of guys that were 6'8 and above. You know, you had Hogan, who was probably, you know, was less than that. And you had Don Leo and John Studd and Mulligan. And they're like 6'5", 6'6", type of guys. So Andre still towered over them. Whereas now, if you, you know, with the Kevin Nash and you did have Ernie Ladd was close to Andre's height, but Sky High Lee and Grizzly Smith. But I don't even remember Grizzly Smith ever working with Andre. I mean, he probably did at some point, but you didn't really have on a national basis, you know, the Kevin Nash, Big Show type of guy. So Andre's height, unless he was in there with like a Mulligan, really, or Kowalski, really stood out. And even with them, his dimensions were so large. And even, you know, if he was even in with Big Show now, the one thing with the two of them together is even if the height wouldn't be different, Andre still had those dimensions, you know, because of the acromegaly that went unchecked, you know, with the giant hands and the giant feet and the giant head that Paul White really didn't have at the same, you know, at the same level. He still had that, you know, a weird feeling when you watch Andre, there was this feeling of inhuman power, as opposed to just being a tall, heavy guy.
Pat, why you talk about the acromegaly, and I know Paul White and Great Khali, I mentioned Dalip Singh, obviously Great Khali, same guy. They had the surgery to get rid of the gland that causes the acromegaly. I believe Ron Reese did too, who was in WCW for a while. He was the big, whatever they called him, T-Rex or whatever his name was. I can't remember what his name was, but
Yeti,
but he had another name too, though. I guess maybe it was just Ron Reese. Pat, was that surgery available for Andre to get in the 70s? And if so, why did he never get that done?
Oh, yeah, the surgery was available for him. I'm presuming that, I think it was misinformed, in the sense that he first learned about the disease in Japan in January of 1970. Was it there that he was misinformed in it with a different language? It was in his own country. I mean, he was still living in France at the time. But even though, even in 1981, when he was, when he got the surgery on his ankle, he was told again that, you know, he had the disease and that, you know, he could get surgery. And he always refused to get it. The way he was explaining it to Jackie McCauley, with her husband, Frenchy Bernard, was were living in Andre's ranch, and then was taking care of the ranch for him when he was away. You know, he was saying to them that God made him this way, and he didn't want to change it. And he was also scared that his dimensions were going to change if he was getting the surgery. The dimensions that Dave was just talking about, you know, is larger than life dimensions. He thought that you would lose what made him special. And, you know, I have to think that he was misinformed because, I mean, it would have not changed that much, especially later in life. But, you know, that's the choice he made. I cannot explain it. I cannot understand it, but I can explain it.
I mean, Paul White's probably the best example because I think that Paul had the surgery, I think, like, when he was about 20, 21. Like, when, you know, he was in college at the time. And if he didn't have the surgery, he probably would have, as he aged, been more and more similar to Andre. But Paul still was able to have a wrestling career, and he's still a larger-than-life giant. And if you remember when Andre first, if you look at the early 70s, let's say, when Andre first became an attraction, it really hadn't hit. It really wasn't until, I mean, it was a gradual onset, but you know, by the time, like the dimensions that he had, let's say when he was 24-ish, if he had, you know, got it taken care of then, which was in Japan, he still was going to be taller than everybody, and he was still going to be bigger than everybody. It wouldn't have been like he was in the 80s with the giant hands and the giant feet. But he didn't really need that at the time anyway, because the Andre the Giant of the 70s was already a big attraction before it really you know, took its course, so to speak.
You can also see a difference between him. If you look at YouTube clips from him wrestling in France back in 1968, he was still tall and lean. And you can really see that he changed 2 years later when there's a YouTube clip from, I believe, October of 1970. And you could see his dimensions are already changed. So it was really a progress. And later in the 70s and then the 80s, it was even worse, you know. But you could see the evolution of the disorder throughout the years.
You know, it's interesting. You see a couple pictures of him, like you mentioned, as a young man. He almost looks like a young Lou Ferrigno. They've got the same sort of face. And then as he gets older, he doesn't have those Ferrigno features anymore. Like you said, you can see his head just growing completely.
Yeah, he kind of goes.
Yeah.
At the end, he's almost like if you look at the pictures of the French Angel, who was a big star in wrestling in the 40s.
Right.
People who don't know the French Angel but will know Shrek, you know, the cartoon character who was based on the French Angel.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Andre developed, you know, more and more because the French Angel had the same disease and was a huge attraction in wrestling, but he was much shorter. I think he was 5'10", 5'11", but he had the same
right.
the same type of growth in the hands and the head.
What's that guy's name? Oh, Lars Sullivan, same thing. He's kind of got the giantism without being a giant.
Lars Sullivan had the same operation, yeah.
Right, right. But it's interesting. So one thing about your book, Pat, is it's so expansive as far as Andre's early career in the 60s and 70s. But for me, when I got into wrestling was about 83 or so through my grandmother. So I think Andre came through AWA a few times. But when WWF went national, he was just kind of everyone knew Andre the Giant and he was in WWE. But I didn't realize how long he'd actually been wrestling for. And I didn't realize that he was almost that kind of the down part of his career at that point in time because they promoted him so well.
Yeah, I mean, in 1983... Andre was wrestling for 17 years by then.
Wow.
He started in 1966 back in France. I mean, even before coming to Montreal, he had wrestled in Japan, throughout Europe, in England, in Africa. I mean, he had almost toured the world even before coming to North America in 1971. By 1983, he was such a well-known, he was the most known pro wrestler in the world by 1983. And Vince used him a lot in the new territory that he was trying to get, you know, when he wanted to go national. So every big town that he was going to produce a show for the first time, he was bringing Andre with him because he was such a big attraction that it would almost guarantee him a big attendance on his first time there. There's a few towns that he didn't use Andre because Andre was still traveling to Japan. So when he was in Japan, he wasn't, you know, he couldn't be used for those. And Montreal was one of them. And the belief is that even when he came back from Japan, he wasn't used in Montreal. And the belief was that he didn't want to go head to head with his good friend Gino Brito, who he was partner with a few years prior when international wrestling was created in 1980. So, Andre was a huge part of the national extension that the WWF did in 83, 84.
Dave, what was the difference in the relationship between Andre and Vince Sr. and Andre and Vince Jr.?
Well, with Vince Sr., Vince Sr. was like his booker, and came in 73 from Montreal, and Paul Vachon sent him to Vince Sr., and Vince Sr. basically came up with the idea that he's got to tour all over rather than stay in one place. So he was essentially very similar to like the NWA World Champion, you know, where he would just be constantly touring all over the world. And when Vince Jr. came in, or took over in 82, you know, he started setting in place the seeds of this national expansion. And he's still in 83. Vince Sr. was still, I think, booking Andre. And I think around 84 was when all of a sudden the other promoters started, like, not getting any dates on Andre or asking for Andre dates on certain days and being told no. And that was kind of like, I remember Paul Bosch and Peter Burkholz actually told me that they, when they realized that Vince was actually going to war with them, you know, because they were all getting along. You know, they were all, you know, all the promoters, I don't want to say get along, but they worked together, was when they asked for Andre for their annual Battle Royal in January, which he would come to every year, and they were told no. And then all of a sudden, it's like, uh-oh, something's up here. And at that point, under Vince Jr., he became WWF, but he still would work Japan, you know, all the way through. He actually, after he was done in WWF and never worked in North America anymore, he worked in Japan until, what was it, about 2 months before his death? You know, I mean, right until the end almost. He was still in December 86.
He was still wrestling in Japan in November or December of 1992, so just before his death. The big difference between the way that Vince Sr. and Vince Jr. used Andre is that Vince Sr. didn't use him much in his own territory because he was getting a cut on Andre when he was traveling all over the world. So he was making money out of Andre without using him in his own territory. And what he had learned from the Vachon and Grand Prix Wrestling is that if you used Andre too much in the same territory, he wasn't going to draw as much as he would when you first book him. So he sent Andre all over the place, still making money out of him, and that's what Andre liked. He could travel the world, visiting different friends from different offices, different promotions. And I think that's what he didn't like from Vince Jr. in the sense that Vince Jr. kept him more in his own territory, and Andre didn't have to see all of his friends. You know, it was the same locker room traveling. He was still traveling throughout North America, but it was the same locker room over and over. And I think that Andre had a lot of bitterness to Vince Jr. because of this. It changed the whole way Andre was used to doing things.
It's interesting. Interesting point. Something else too that I love reading in the book, because I know a few of these stories, and we can discuss one in particular in a few seconds, but just how much respect Andre had from the boys, as far as if he didn't want to do something, he wouldn't do it. If he wanted somebody to get fired, they would get fired. And that seemed to continue on all the way into WWF times, and you mentioned that even he didn't like Randy Savage or he didn't like Bam Bam Bigelow. How much influence did he really have with the office, and how much of this is the folklore of Andre the Giant?
I mean, he was so influential because he was such a big attraction that you didn't want to say no to Andre. I'll give you an example. You know, he was working for Inoki in Japan, for New Japan, in the mid to late 70s. And the first promotion he worked for in Japan was IWE. And the promoter there, Yoshihara, is the first one to have brought him to Japan. And Andre was always loyal to the first people who actually, you know, gave him a chance in the business. And when he heard that Yoshihara had trouble with his promotion, when IWE wasn't a player anymore, you know, it was all about New Japan and then All Japan, he went to work for Yoshihara for a few days. And Inoki wasn't going to say no. He would have not allowed anyone else to do so. But Andre was so respected, and Andre meant so much business that, you know, he would have not said no to Andre in fear of Andre just not willing to work for him anymore. It wasn't worth it because IWE wasn't much of a competition for him in a way. And I believe that it was the same case in other stories about Andre. I mean, he was so valuable for so many promoters and so well respected as well that, you know, he was having its way on a lot of occasions.
Well, you know, the one story that this reminds me of is, and Chris, you'll kind of understand this one, because when you were in Japan, you know, I mean, New Japan and All Japan were kind of like the big two.
Right.
Andre, for the bulk of his Japanese career, worked for New Japan and Inoki, and Inoki and Andre was a big, big feud. And it got to a point, I mean, New Japan and All Japan were different in the sense, New Japan was a very hard athletic style. And after whatever it was, 85, 86, I forgot the year, it was pretty much, they understood that they didn't have a place for Andre anymore. He couldn't work that main event style anymore. His body was turning on him. And Inoki actually let, and he may even have asked Baba But whatever it was, even though those companies were warring, the respect for Andre was such that Inoki and Baba was, it was kind of a deal like, Baba, you know, please book Andre. Because Baba would have a comedy match in the middle of the card that Baba himself was in with some of the older guys, you know, that weren't going to work a hard style, but they're there and everybody's happy to see Baba at the house show. And they would be really happy to see Andre, but he's no longer main event. And that's why, you know, long after Andre was able to work in the United States, he continued to work with Baba until the very end, because it was a lighthearted match where the demands weren't there, you know, to where Andre couldn't do it anymore and it wouldn't embarrass Andre trying to work with faster, more athletic young guys. And so the idea that a great attraction like Andre in the middle of a wrestling war, and those guys warred with, you know, those two companies warred with each other for decades, that they would have an agreement that, hey, Andre's special, you have to take care of him, and we just can't do it anymore, so please take him. I mean, that's one of the more amazing stories when it comes to the power and how much Andre was loved and respected.
Did Vince have that same attitude? Vince Jr. Have the same attitude about Andre, that we have to take care of this guy as much as we can?
I mean, they definitely had a falling out at the end, because, and Pat would know more about it than me, but, and it was even in the documentary, it was, you know, Vince even acknowledged it, that Vince had to, at one point, you know, I think that there was a point where they were going to use him as a manager or something, and I remember they did an angle with Earthquake. There were a couple of things where it looked like Andre was going to come back, and then he didn't, and then he was just pretty much gone.
Mm-hmm.
He did do the one appearance on WCW television, which Vince hated, you know, really bad. I remember that. It was like an anniversary show. He didn't wrestle or anything. It was just an anniversary special on TBS. And Andre was the guest, and I was amazed. You know, and Andre was on crutches then, which kind of, you know, was really sad to see. But Andre being on that show, you know, Vince was very upset that Andre appeared on that show, but Vince had stopped using him,
mm-hmm.
and Andre was upset that Vince had stopped using him.
Andre didn't know what else to do than wrestling.
Right.
It was his whole life. It was the only place for him. A wrestling locker room was the only place for him where he felt normal.
Right.
You know, everywhere he was going, he was pointed at, he was laughed at, he was yelled at, he was cheered, he was, children would want a picture, would cry in front of him, depending if the kid was scared or not of Andre, but he couldn't live a normal life. The only place where he felt like any other human being was a wrestling locker room. He didn't want this to stop. And at one point, well, you know, Vince kind of tried to make him understand that, you know, his wrestling career was pretty much over, and he felt a lot of resentment against Vince because of this. And I mean, their falling out is pretty much, you know, because of this. It wasn't nothing that Vince did wrong. He was just trying to tell Andre that, you know, you should retire, and Andre wasn't ready for that, and that's why he kept going. He kept wrestling in Mexico, and he kept wrestling in Japan, even though it was so hard for any fan of Andre to watch this, and they wouldn't know more than me, because he watched those matches as they were happening. But I mean, he just kept going and didn't want to retire, and that's where the falling out with Vince came.
It's funny, too, just as a quick segue, that we just did The Dark Side of the Ring. I was mentioning to Pat the Dino Bravo episode. But also in the Herb Abrams episode, you see Andre was in UWF for a short period of time, one appearance, and then Vince brought Andre back right away, right after that. But point being, why wouldn't Vince just have hired Andre on to be an ambassador to the company? Because the way that, of course, the history of the WWE is always kind of written to whatever they want to say. They have the Andre the Giant Battle Royal every year at WrestleMania. And if he was such a big attraction to the McMahon family since the 70s, why not just sign him to some kind of ambassador role?
I think that if it was today, 100% that's what would happen.
Right.
And I'm thinking that it wasn't even the finances, because you could go, well, you know, I mean, because they really were making enough money to where something like that, they could do it. I think it's probably, he just didn't come up with that idea yet. You know what I mean? Of having a guy, like, he would, you know, he took care of Blassie, okay, until Blassie's death. But Blassie still would be a guy whose job would be in the office, and he would call up radio stations and cut promos on radio stations to build up, you know, the local matches, you know, and everything. But Andre, like, he really, there was like no role where Andre would call up radio stations because he really wasn't a great radio interview, obviously, because it was, you know, things like that. So I think that, you know, yeah, Andre probably today had come along. Look at Big Show. He's not wrestling hardly at all anymore. And he'll be with the company forever. Or Mark Henry, you know, they'll have an affiliation. If it was today, for sure he would. It's just, I just think Vince never came up with it. And in those days, when you're done, you're done. And
yeah.
In his mind, there was just nothing in the ring you could do with Andre anymore.
Let's talk about some of the funnier stories in there. Like why Andre didn't like Randy Savage. I thought that was a great story.
Yeah. I mean, Andre didn't like Randy. And you know, watching the documentary, you have a feel, you know, that Andre really didn't like Randy. And when I spoke to Lanny Poffo, Randy's brother, about it, it was like, oh, yeah, that is 100% true. Andre didn't like my brother. And the reason why is that Randy was wrestling with baby oil on, and Andre didn't like it one bit. and even Lanny tried to tell Randy, you know, why don't you put any baby oil when you're wrestling Andre? And he didn't want to make any exceptions. The reason behind it, and people have to understand, Andre, it was hard for, nothing was made for Andre, you know. Mm-hmm. It was hard for him to take a shower when he was coming back to his hotel room, because the shower in the hotel he was living at weren't made for a person of his size.
Yeah.
So it was hard. Sometimes he would prefer just to stay at the bar alone at night and keep drinking than having to go back to his room and doing nothing and all that. So, I mean, can you imagine if Andre was full of baby oil on after a match with Randy? It's hard for us. It would be hard for us to get rid of all that baby oil, let alone Andre, who had trouble just getting in a shower to begin with. So I think Randy never understood that. And Andre probably never explained it to Randy because of proud, maybe because of he was too proud, or maybe he wanted Randy to find the explanation himself, you know. But he really didn't like Randy. He was one of them, you know. I mean, he didn't like John Studd. He didn't like Aaron Shee. There was a few, like, if Andre liked you, he really liked you. But if he disliked you, man, you would feel it.
I heard Heenan used to always say that he didn't like Ultimate Warrior either.
Oh, really?
Ultimate Warrior, he didn't like the way he worked. He was stiff, you know, and there's this great story with Bobby Heenan, who said that, you know, once, every time Warrior was coming up with his clothesline, he was stiff, and Andre didn't like it one bit. And then one time Warrior came to do his clothesline, and Andre just put his fist in front of him, and Warrior ran into his fist. And the next time he did a clothesline, and he did it so light, and Andre, you know, bumped for him and sold for him, like he came up at full speed. And Andre looked at Heenan and said, "He's learning." So after that, I think it was all right. I think it was all right with Warrior after that.
There's a great story in the book, and I know this story, and it's pretty much verbatim from what I was told, because as you guys know, I started in Calgary, which is where Bad News Allen was from and lived. So my first 3 or 4 years in the business, I worked with Bad News quite a bit, either on the same shows, or we had kind of a heel faction, me and Bad News and Don Callis at one point in the little local Winnipeg thing. So I heard that story with Andre and Bad News, which was pretty much verbatim the way that News explained it, because he was not a bullshitter. Bad News is one of the few guys I've ever met in wrestling who didn't add the wrestling embellishments. Dave, you know that story. Why don't you tell it? And I'll tell you the finish to it that's not in the book from what Bad News told me.
Yeah, I mean, Bad News is the one who actually told me the same story, so I'm sure I heard exactly what you heard. They were on a bus.
In Japan.
You know, with New Japan.
Yeah.
And I guess Andre said something racial, and Bad News, the way he told me the story was just like, you know, he wasn't going to put up with it. And he said, like, sometimes there's the story of, like, Bad News thought he could beat him up. And Bad News, to me, was like, look, I'm not saying that I could beat him up or that I scared him, but I was going to go down fighting. You know, it's just like, you just don't say that. And Bad News was, you know, one of the toughest guys ever, you know, I mean, anyway, on his own.
Yeah.
He had words with Andre and, you know, basically like, you know, don't say it and you know, don't say that stuff around me. And he absolutely was willing to fight him. And whether he would win the fight or lose the fight, it didn't matter. He was willing to fight over it. But Andre just kind of was like, okay, it's whatever, you know, like that.
Well, he said, pull the bus over. And he went to the bus driver.
Right, pulled the bus
and
over.
And Bad News, like you said, one of the toughest, also very intimidating. Like every blaxploitation Jim Brown movie from the 70s of these badass black dudes, that was Bad News. And he said to the bus driver, and he even remembered the bus driver's name. I can't remember what the bus driver's name was, but he said, pull over. Hanson was saying, don't do it. And he said, do it, pull over. The bus driver wouldn't pull over. But like it says in the book, that Bad News waited up all night long for Andre. He was so pissed off. And when Andre came out in the morning, he apologized. And News said that they ain't going to fly. You need to, whatever the finish of it was. How was that resolved, Pat?
Well, I mean, Bad News, he was really offended by what Andre said, right? And he wasn't going to put up with it. And he really wanted to make sure that Andre understood that, you know, he was not to use that word again in front of Bad News Brown, you know, and Bad News Allen, as it was called at the time. So, I mean, it was really important. And I mean, it was important to us to talk about it in the book as well, because it happened on two occasions. It happened with Bad News, it happened with Kamala as well. Mm-hmm. And both times Andre apologized, and both Kamala and Bad News were okay with Andre after they had to talk with him. But the thing was that it was important for us to talk about this in the book, because we didn't want to just talk about the good things of Andre. We wanted to have a real portrait of Andre. And like any human being, he made mistakes.
Right.
And he did bad calls. And this was one of them, you know? So it was important for us to mention that in the book. That said, he was never considered as a racist. He did some, you know, obviously he did some racist remarks, but he was never considered by News and Kamala as racist. And he worked with, you know, plenty of Afro-Americans throughout the years. And you know, this is the only two occasions that we have heard of, but it was important for us to mention them as well.
The epilogue of the story that News told me was years later when they worked in Mexico. They worked for Minas there at UWF, that that Andre was having some issues with his stomach, and basically gave Bad News. Remember, Andre used to just basically stick his ass in your face in the corner type thing. And basically when he did that, he farted and filled his pants with diarrhea that was in Bad News's face. And I still can hear Bad News laughing about that story, like, this motherfucker, he shit all over my face. That was revenge for me calling him out in Japan.
Yeah, he was.
I mean,
he actually used that.
And when Bad News was talking about it on interviews, you could see that he felt so bad for Andre.
Yeah.
You know, he knew he didn't do it on purpose, and you know, it just happened. You know, and you could feel that he felt so bad for Andre, and Andre must have felt bad as well. You know, it was just, you know, it happened, you know. Yeah.
What were you going to say, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, it was that seated splash thing where he would stick his butt on the guy and jump on him.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing, too, is I remember, I think Bad News said that, like, you know, he was just, like, throwing up. I mean, it was, like, the grossest thing probably his entire life. You know, when that happened, it was just, like, he'd start vomiting and everything when they, you know, it's Andre's diarrhea all over his face.
Let's talk about the biggest angle of Andre's career, at least as far as I know, as a teenager growing up and being just enthralled by WWF. Of course, Hogan and Andre for WrestleMania 3. Give us a little bit of background of that story, Dave, and Vince's genius decision to turn Andre heel at that point after being the babyface of all babyfaces in the States for a decade.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, you know, Andre was always a heel in Japan, and I always liked, you know, when, you know, growing up with Andre as a babyface and then seeing him as a heel in Japan was so fascinating to me. and I liked him more because, you know, just from your own thing, as a heel, there's just more things that you can do in a lot of ways, and it's I don't want to say more fulfilling. I mean, everyone's different, but Andre was more interesting to me as a heel going against the smaller Japanese wrestlers. I found the matches a lot more interesting. So, but in the United States, you know, he never was, and I always wondered, you know, Andre worked with Hogan, you know, all over in 1980. I mean, and even earlier in Dothan, Alabama was the real famous one that really, Pat and I talked about this the other day. I think that the Dothan, Alabama match kind of made Hulk Hogan's career in a lot of ways because they had this record crowd in this small city. And then all of a sudden, you know, Hogan was just a guy working a small territory. He was nobody famous or anything. And all of a sudden it's like, this guy drew 5,000 people in Dothan, Alabama. Maybe there's something to him. And that's where he got his job in Georgia, which got him on national television through that. And through Georgia was WWF. And then WWF, they did the Andre Hogan angle, which played all over the United States because Vince's father was running the company. And they would send the tapes to New Orleans for the Superdome or Los Angeles. I remember seeing in Los Angeles TV, you know, and there were probably a lot of other places where it was the angle from the WWF television where Hogan clotheslined him with a foreign object and Andre bled, and then Hogan body slammed him, and it was a real impressive looking slam. And all of a sudden, Hogan is this larger than life guy as a heel. But then Hogan goes to the AWA and becomes much bigger than he ever was in WWF. And Andre would come in from time to time, and they would be a tag team against, I think they often would wrestle like four, Hogan and Andre against like four heels, something like that. And even then I was like, you know, why don't they do Hogan and Andre and have Andre go heel? Because Hogan's so over. But, you know, maybe Vince Sr. never allowed it, you know, because Andre never worked heel, you know. And then when Vince Sr.'s out of the picture, 86, Vince Sr.'s already passed away. To me, it was always obvious. It's the obvious thing. Hulk Hogan, this giant baby face. Andre goes heel with Bobby Heenan. And, you know, as soon as they did that, you know, I'm not going to say that I knew that they were going to sell at the Pontiac Silverdome. But the minute that angle was shot, I was like, they're going to set the all-time attendance record. And I was figuring 40 to 60,000 like that. The minute I saw that angle, I was like, this is going to break every attendance record because it's, you know, Andre was undefeated in North America in everyone's eyes. You know, no one remembered the matches with the Sheik or whatever. It's been so long. And Hogan, nobody had seen him lose since he came back to WWF. And Hogan, by this point, this is 87. Hogan's already larger than life. You know, Hogan really hit it big, I would say 84, 85, you know, with the Cyndi Lauper stuff. And so this is already a couple of years in. Hogan's gigantic. Andre's Andre the Giant, never been a heel before. And, you know, the way they did it, you know, it was a slow build. It wasn't like they shot the angle on Raw on Monday and then 3 weeks later on the pay-per-view, they did it. I mean, it was January and you got the match at the end of March. So he had three hard months of, you know, getting the story going. And by the time the match came, I mean, everybody was waiting for that match with bated breath. I mean, I would call it, I think it's fair to say it was the biggest pro wrestling match ever in North America. I mean, you could argue there's two or three others, but I would put it number one, just, you know, looking back and everything like that. I mean, you know, Austin Rock was big at WrestleMania 17, and you can go with like Gotch and Hackenschmidt and, you know, whatever.
Bret Hart
and Shawn in some ways, but I really think Hogan and Andre would be, if I was to say like the biggest match in the history of North American wrestling, that would be the one I would say.
Let me tell you the reason why, Dave, just to add on to that. The reason why I think it's the biggest is because it's still 1987. For me, as a 16-year-old kid, I kind of knew what wrestling was, but I didn't know for sure. I believed it. It was real. You know, I had seen a couple times where someone, you know, whispered backdrop and then somebody took a backdrop, but it hadn't clued into me yet that this was all show business. So that angle, to me, the reason why it is the biggest match is because when Andre ripped Hogan's shirt off, and I still remember, you guys talk about in the book, and it ripped his cross off and a happy accident of, you know, cutting his chest with his fingernail and that blood dripping down, I believed it every single bit of it. Like, Andre the Giant just turned on Hulk Hogan and went with the Heenan family, and like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? So I think it was kind of one of the last few times before the early 90s when you had a big angle that kids like me believed in it 1,000%.
the other one too is that even though, like, I will say that, like, you know, I knew obviously Hogan was going to win and it made sense. The fact is that nobody had ever seen Andre lose, and nobody could even envision the idea of Andre losing, and nor could they envision the idea of Hogan losing, which created a dynamic. You know, it's like, how do you repeat it? And it's like, you know, I remember someone asked me once, like, how do you repeat it? And I go, well, you know, like, have one guy go undefeated for 5 years and have one guy go undefeated for 15 years, and you might be able to match it. You know what I mean?
Right. What do you think, Pat?
What is the most fascinating thing to me about this is that in many of the books or documentaries done on Andre, is the story is that WrestleMania 3 was his last great moment, and after that, you know, it went down the road.
Yeah.
And in fact, to me, it was the beginning of his last run, in the sense that the feud between Hogan and Andre was so big and so huge that it was the foundation of the early WWF pay-per-views. After WrestleMania 3, he had the back surgery. That many things that happened before WrestleMania 3, but in fact, it was after WrestleMania 3 that he got the surgery. And then he came back and did the Survivor Series match on the very first Survivor Series, and it was Team Hogan against Team Andre. And then in January of 1988, it was the first Royal Rumble, and aside from the Rumble match, the big draw was Hogan and Andre's contract signing for the February 5th, 1988 match at Main Event Primetime on NBC that drew 33 million people when Andre defeated Hogan for the title, and you know, that whole storyline selling the title to DiBiase. And then WrestleMania 4 was all about Andre and Hogan's rematch. And then SummerSlam of 1988, so the very first SummerSlam, it was the Mega Box against the Mega Powers, again using Andre and Hogan as the main feud. So you know, when we talk about the Big Four, you know, as far as pay-per-views goes, I mean, the Big Four was Mania, Survivor Series, Rumble, and SummerSlam, and two of them were created on the Hogan and Andre feud. So it was something that was never really explained that way, and for us, it was really, really important to put that feud into context and see really how much good it did to WWF at the time.
The other part of that feud, and when you're talking about those dates, and the SummerSlam would be the exception, but almost all of those dates were head-to-head with the Jim Crockett Promotions Mega Show.
Yep.
So Andre was there. You know, they were in a bitter promotional war, and you know, essentially by blocking them and going head-to-head and using the Andre Hogan feud, which was so big after WrestleMania 3, it was still big, you know, really put Jim Crockett Promotions out of business, you know, by the use of the way that they strategically used Hogan Andre. Because you got to remember, aside from those dates that you mentioned, and you know, there was a couple of house shows. There was a stadium show in Milwaukee. Yep. There was a show in Greensboro that didn't do so well. But Andre and Hogan were kept apart, except when Jim Crockett had a big one, or when they wanted to develop the SummerSlam show, you know, as a foundation. They were not wrestling each other week in and week out on television or at house shows or anything. It was only on those dates that were important dates.
Let's talk about the actual day of the show of WrestleMania 3. Hulk, God bless him, greatest storyteller in the business, you know, saying he doesn't know what the finish is and all this other stuff. And then also you explained too in the book about Andre's condition and kind of the state he was in during the match. Let's talk about that day and how that match went down and the finish and Andre's attitude and all that other stuff.
I mean, it was pretty much Andre playing in Hogan's head. In the documentary, I mean, for some reasons, they decided to believe Hogan's story about how, you know, it went down and about how he came into the match not knowing if Andre would be the job for him or not. In reality, I mean, it was just Andre playing in Hogan's head. I mean, he was that kind of guy. He was always a prankster. He was always, you know, trying to have fun with you know, his opponents and stuff like that. And his definition of fun is very different than other people. You got to remember that this is the guy who actually was very good friends with Dusty Rhodes, and he decided that as a prank, he would pee on Dusty's head. And it was funny to him, and Dusty thought it was funny as well. So for him, playing Hogan's head was just another prank, you know? And that was confirmed to us by Pat Patterson, you know? So Pat, I mean, Andre was always going to do the right thing. There was no mistake about it. He was just having fun with Hulk. And probably that Hulk kind of became stressed about it. He knew it was a big match, you know? And maybe he just started getting stressed about, you know, well, you know, is Andre really going to do the job for me? And it worked. But at the end of the day, Andre was never going to put himself over, and he was always going to do business about it. You know, that was Andre.
But there was a match in New Orleans about 7 years earlier. I'm sure you know the story where, and I think it was a miscommunications issue. Maybe it wasn't. There was a show at the Superdome. It was during Andre and Hogan, neither of whom worked the territory, but they were brought in as kind of like a special attraction on the show. And in all those matches, Andre won. And at the Superdome, for whatever reason, it was a double count out. According to Watts, he said to Andre, you know, they wanted Andre to win. And I don't know if Hogan said no. I don't know why he would have, because in every other city he put Andre over, but whatever. Somehow the word got, and they did do a double, I think it was a double count out finish or something. But Andre heard that Hogan wouldn't put him over, and Andre made Hogan's life absolutely miserable in that match.
Yeah, I mean, it was a few weeks before the Shea Stadium match in 1980. And I mean, for whatever reason, it seems like Hogan didn't want to do the job for Andre. I don't know if it had anything to do with the Shea Stadium where he knew he was gonna, you know, lose. But at the end of the day, Andre told Watts that, you know, he was gonna take care of it. And when Andre was saying that, it wasn't necessarily good news for his opponent, because Andre knew how to take care of things in the ring, you know, in only one fashion. So Hogan probably got a good beat up by Andre. But at the end of the day, Andre decided to do a double count out. But, you know, it was 7 years before. So, I mean, a lot of things, you know, Andre was invited to Hogan's wedding 3 years later. So, I mean, everything was settled between the two.
Oh, yeah.
By the time that WrestleMania 3 happened. But maybe Hogan still has that in the back of his mind. I don't know. But definitely it was in 87, Andre knew that, you know, it was the other way around, and he was an elite Hogan this time.
Talking about matches and angles that I'll never forget, I used to work in a deli, like whatever night it was, where Andre had the match with Hogan and beat him and then sold the title to DiBiase. I was working the deli, and my best friend came running in because he was able to see it, and I was recording it. And he goes, "You're not going to believe this. What? There's an evil twin referee, and dollar bills were falling out of his pocket, and Andre the Giant won the title and sold it to and I was like, what? And I couldn't wait to finish up my shift so I could get the hell out of there and go home and find out what happened. Talk about another unbelievably great angle for that follow up match.
Yeah, that was you know, like Dave Hebner was working for Vince, and Earl Hebner was a referee for Crockett, and like a week before, you know, Earl gave his notice, you know, which was surprising to go to work up there, and that was the deal. You know, they did that twin Hebner referee thing, and just all the confusion, and you know, the whole idea obviously was to build for the you know, the tournament to at the next WrestleMania for the championship that would be vacant, which was a way to get the title. I mean, I guess originally on Ted DiBiase, but later on Randy, it ended up being the decision was made for Randy Savage to get it. Which led to, in my mind, actually the greatest 1 year storyline in WWF history, which was the Hogan Savage thing. You know, because I thought that the WrestleMania was it 5, mm-hmm. Hogan Savage was another monster match. You know, in which it didn't have to do as much to do with Andre, but that whole run from 3 to 5 with the usage of Andre and Hogan. And then Hogan and Andre going out in that tournament with a double disqualification. So the two big guns are out, and then it clears the way for Randy to win. And then Hogan having never lost to Randy then going heel and all that. That was the way that went down. That was some of the best stuff they ever did.
And the fact also that they when DBSZ was, quote-unquote, bought the world title from Andre, he even defended it a couple of times, right, the days after February 5th, before, it was announced by Jack Tunney that the title would be held vacant. So that is another fascinating thing, that he actually defended the title at least on one occasion, but he wore the belt on other matches as well. And the whole thing about DiBiase coming to the WWF at the time, it's a fascinating story as well, in the sense that he was told by Vince that he wanted to bring him. He had a special idea for him, something that would make him a lot of money, but he didn't want to tell him what the gimmick was going to be before he actually signed, because he thought that the gimmick was really, really a good idea, and he didn't want to take the chance that if DiBiase wasn't going to sign with him, that he would, know about the idea and tell the promoters about it, I guess. So pretty much DiBiase signed the contract without even knowing what he was going to be doing in the WWF. He probably never regretted it since it was, I mean, Hogan and Savage was a great feud, but I arguably Hogan and Andre is probably one of the, best feuds in the history of the promotion as well.
Was there any specific reason, or was Andre just confused? I remember when, you talked about the book, but seeing it where he said, I'm now selling the world tag team championship to Ted DiBiase or whatever the hell. What did he say exactly?
Well, we did ask Gene Okerlund about this, since it was him in the ring with Andre, and we said, well, that's the thing that Andre could get away with. According to Gene, no one ever told Andre anything about this, and he said it twice. Mm. For God's sake, he said it twice, and no one ever told him anything. That's the thing that Andre just could get away with.
I mean, the one thing on that one, because at that time, live television was rare.
Right.
It would have been, if it was any other thing, it would have been edited off, but they were actually live, so they couldn't edit it off.
Yeah, it just is one of those things you just added to the whole, and I was going to say, too, here's another thing that could never happen in this day and age with internet and, the mass distribution of Wrestling Observer and all that other stuff. The fact that nobody knew that Dave Hebner had a twin brother.
Well, people knew he had a twin brother, but they didn't know that he was, because he was a referee with Crockett, but they didn't know. Yeah, I don't think anyone knew when he gave notice, because he didn't give notice and tell them, what the angle was. I think if he told them what the angle was, it probably would have gotten out ahead of time, but he just gave notice, and there he was, and it was live. But yeah, of course, if that was back in those days normal, it would have been taped 3 weeks earlier before we saw it. And if that was the case, of course everybody would know ahead of time. Because most Saturday night's main events, the only live ones were the Friday night ones. The Saturday night main events were always taped, anywhere from a day to a month ahead of time.
Was that a Vince angle or just from his whole booking team?
I don't know. I don't know who actually came up with it. But, in that era, it's Vince and it's
Pat.
Vince and it's Pat and Pat Patterson. Yeah. So it's one of the two.
What a great idea. Did you talk to Pat at all for any of this? Pat LaPre, did you talk to Pat Patterson at all for any of the research for the book?
Yeah. We did. Since Bertrand, the my co-author with the book, he's the one who wrote Pat's biography, accepted. So, we know Pat. And Bertrand spoke to him about Andre and everything. So we did speak to him, and as I was saying, he's the one who told us that Hogan knew about that Andre would do the job for him, and give us a few. He was very close to Andre for a number of years, because not only because they worked together for a long time with Vince, and they both were close to Vince Sr., but also Andre, as you know, if you spoke French, automatically you were Andre's friend.
Right.
You didn't need more. So you were close friends with Rick Martel, with Gino Brito, with French Martin, with with one of your favorite wrestlers' names ever, Trish, Shell the Fish Poisson.
I love it.
he was friends with all of those Quebec guys, and Pat, you know, was one of the closest to Andre.
Well, one of the things when, you know, Andre, in the 70s when he would tour, you know, obviously he'd come to Northern California, and Pat Patterson was the top attraction, and Patterson and Andre always were together when Andre would do his, you know, and I mean, it was usually only a couple of days a year, but when he would come here, you know, they were always together because Pat was the one guy who, he was friends with Pepper Gomez, but Pat was the guy who spoke French, and I remember when I was a kid, they did it was a charity telethon together, you know, which was really interesting because Andre, you know, didn't do a lot of stuff in that type of, you know, it was a PBS station, and seeing Andre in there, I mean, even Patterson being out of the wrestling realm was weird for that era. But then you see like all these people, you know, doing the telethon with the phones, and then you've got Andre who's, you know, three times the size of everybody else in there. It was one of those visuals that, you know, I would never forget.
Just a quick segue. I love the fact he's Gilles the Fish Poisson, which Poisson means fish in French.
you were calling Marie Zouillette Poisson, if I remember correctly, because of that.
Yeah, it's our nickname for each other, Poisson. As we start to kind of get to the end here, you know, right after all that stuff that we just spoke about with Andre and then going into the tournament, and then I know they put him with King Haku for a while, and Tongo always told me great stories and great memories of Andre. But how much pain was Andre in towards the end, and how limited were his matches as a result?
I mean, he was in a lot of pain because his body kept growing. He wasn't getting taller, but his body kept growing. His bones were getting larger, and just before a few months before he passed away, he had another crisis of growth, you know, and when those happened, he was in tremendous pain. And plus, if you add the disease he had and all the years of, you know, taking bumps and wrestling so many times a week, never taking a day off, you know, except when he was getting some surgeries, you know, he was in a lot of pain. And that's another reason, Chris, why he was drinking so much. Mm-hmm. Even his drinking changed over the years. You know, Paul Vachon didn't remember Andre drinking hard liquor when he was in Montreal in the early 70s. But by the end of his year, hard liquor was, you know, he was drinking a lot of hard liquor because it would ease his pain. So it was very hard on him. And, you know, he, after his back surgery, he started taking painkillers because, you know, and he was never someone who used, you know, any kind of drugs or pills, you know, to ease his pain. You know, drinking was probably the only thing he was doing. But after his back surgery, he needed painkillers. And it was very hard on him. And that's the reason why he was barely able to wrestle anymore, you know, by the early 1990s, and why he looked so, you know, it wasn't the same Andre when you look at his matches in Japan. And that's why Vince wanted him to retire, you know. So it was very hard on him.
You know, one thing I remember, and I don't remember if it was San Francisco or Oakland, but Andre worked in the Bay Area, and, you know, he worked a match, and he was limited. I remember he was always holding onto the top rope and staying in the corner in the match, in his big spot where he would get tied up in the ropes. You know, that was the one thing that he did pretty much till the end. But it was so sad because after, I remember him, Andre, being in a wheelchair taken to the hotel from the back of the building, you know, rather than walking or anything like that. And it was just like, that's when it really, like, I remember it hit me of, oh my God, like, this guy is like, he's still wrestling, but he's in a wheelchair to get around. I mean, that's, and he still wrestled, I would say, you know, I'm going to say 3 more years after that.
You know, it's interesting when you think about this, about a guy who, you know, his whole life was wrestling, and it would be very hard to, A, have to give that up, and also knowing that his body was was turning on him. And obviously he knew he was going to live a short life, because I think it's something to mention too, Pat, that you talk about. Andre was also a very generous guy, because I think he knew that he didn't have a long time to live on this earth.
Well, yeah, in a sense, that's another reason why we're sure that, you know, he knew about his disease by 1970, because when he came to Montreal, he was already talking to his friends here, like Paul Deschamps, like Paul LeDuc, and telling them that, you know, he didn't have a long life to live. Mm-hmm. He already knew that. That's why he was drinking at first, because he just decided to live life to its fullest, and he was just, you know, a fun guy to be around, drinking, having fun, being generous with his family, with his friends. And then the drinking changed, because he was drinking more because of the pain than just to have fun. And you could see it also in his attitude, you know. By the late 80s, Andre wasn't the same guy. You know, he couldn't be in a big crowd anymore. You know, he was getting frustrated, and he would get angry more often, probably because of all the pain he was in, and probably of, you know, he wasn't a fool. You know, he knew, he understood what Vince was trying to say and was trying to do. And he got that his career, you know, was not going to last for another 10 years. But, you know, that's the only thing he knew. And he wanted to keep doing it until what happened in January of 1993, right? So it was not. Those last years, maybe the last 4 or 5 years of his life, must probably been hell for him.
I think Arnold Schwarzenegger talked about this in the HBO documentary, but I remember the story where Andre and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Wilt Chamberlain were all in Mexico at the same time. Andre was wrestling, and I think Wilt and Arnold were doing a movie.
Yeah, they were filming Conan the Destroyer, yeah.
Conan the Destroyer, and they were all out to dinner. You know, and by this point, Arnold's, not as big a star as he eventually became, but he was absolutely a big, big star. Like, when they went out, it was like, you know, Arnold wanted to pay for dinner, and Andre was just like, no way. You know, it's like, he was almost insulted by the fact that Arnold wanted to pay for dinner.
But more than that, he was actually, when he was in France, when he was starting in the business, and back in 65, 66, when he was training, and you know, had just started, he wasn't making much money. He was alone in Paris, and sometimes he was sleeping in a subway station. He started, you know, working as a doorman in some clubs in Paris, and he was in a district. The wrestling in Paris at the time was in the red light district, where there was a lot of prostitutes there. And Andre knew a lot of them because, you know, he was hanging out, was working, was wrestling in that district. And those women were always very good to Andre. They protected him, and sometimes, you know, they gave him a place to stay. And Andre never forgot about it, to the point that years later, maybe 20 years later, even Montreal with Chino Brito, and he's eating in a restaurant, and there's a prostitute who comes in the restaurant. Something happens. She's not looking good at all. Something, I don't know, she got beaten up or something, but she had lost, oh yeah, exactly, that's the thing, she got stolen from all the money she had, and Andre just reached out to his pocket, give her a few $100, and then he told Gino Brito the story about how back in the day, you know, prostitutes helped him a lot in France, and it was his way to give back, even though it was 20 years ago, and it wasn't, you know, the same person, you know, event, you know. So it was really something. Andre never forgot where he came from, his roots, and that's just how generous he was.
Last two questions for you guys. So many, you know, like I said, when you watch Andre the Giant, there's so many great moments and angles from, you know, a storyline standpoint, but he was a really great worker as well. If you watch some of his stuff in the 70s, what is your personal favorite Andre the Giant match? Dave, I'll start with you. Is there one that pops in your head?
You know, the one that almost everyone will say was his best match was a match with Stan Hansen in Japan, which was an unreal match.
Yeah.
Stan Hansen was already a big star because he won the match, and you wouldn't beat Andre unless you were, you know, big star. It was a count-out finish. I remember that match was so heated, and it was the match that made – it turned Stan Hansen from a big star into a mega star. And, you know, Stan, you know, and not just because of that match, but that match was the catalyst of it. You know, I would say if you ask who the biggest American wrestling star in the history of Japan is, I mean, you could say Dick Beyer from another generation, but of our generation, it would be Stan Hansen in that match. And that might be Stan's most memorable match in Japan as well. So if I would say that I thought that was the best Andre match I ever saw.
And that's the reason why Stan accepted to do the forward for the book, because he had so much respect for Andre. He always said that, you know, Andre made him in Japan after that match. My favorite match, I mean, you know, I was 10 years old at the time. So to me, it's the match that I've seen so many times, and it had to be the match with Hogan. It wasn't the best match of Andre's career, of course not. But, it's still to this day my favorite match of Andre, because it brings back so many memories of my childhood and one of the reasons why, you know, I fell in love with pro wrestling at a young age. And, it would have to be that match.
You know, I also want to bring up, and I presume, and Pat would know this for sure, that there's no tape of this match because I've certainly never seen it. But I would have loved to have seen, and I know it was the first or the second, but it was the DQ finish of Andre and Don Leo Jonathan from Montreal, because it was written up in all the magazines. And so I'm like 12 years old at the time, and I'm reading this, and it's like this fantasy. You know, you envision the match, how it's going with giant Don Leo Jonathan, who's the most athletic big guy of the time, and Andre, who was still not working giant style. I mean, he was still doing a lot more things that people don't realize that he did when he was younger. And then the whole idea of Andre just like losing control and getting disqualified and throwing everyone around. And I mean, the way it was written was like this, it's almost like mythical stuff that you would read and you would envision in your head, and probably was better than it really was. But I always, as a kid, remembered the descriptions of that one Andre the Giant Don Leo Jonathan match.
Yeah, it was the first match in Montreal in May of 1972, and unfortunately, none of the footage is available today. So that's probably the match and the whole series, actually. You know, the three matches between May and September of 1972. It's probably the matches that I would have loved to see the most.
For me, of course, I got to go Hogan and Andre just because of the story and the monumental, you know, just how big it was for me as a kid. But from a work rate, that Dave stole mine. I love the handsome one. But there's another really cool one that I saw. I watched it a couple days ago when I knew we were going to do this. I'd seen it before, but it's the Andre versus Abdul the Butcher from Puerto Rico in 1983. And it's not long. It's only about, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes. But Andre, it's still when he was wearing tights, short tights. He's still in pretty good mobility. And he just goes out there and just kicks the shit out of Abby, which is great because, you know, Butcher never sold anything or really ever ran the ropes. But in this one, he's doing whatever the hell Andre wants him to do. But when Andre sells for him, he makes him. He knew that Butcher was a top guy in Puerto Rico. And when it's Abby's turn to fire back, Andre's there for it. It's a really cool little moment between these two really big guys who aren't really known for selling, who go out there and you know, sell the shit out of stuff. And of course it ends like in a giant double count out on the floor. it's a cool one to watch.
There's also one, I don't know if Dave you remember it, but I watched it online while doing the research on the book. But it was a 1978 or 1979 match against Harley Race in Houston. That is available.
I have never seen that match, but people have told me that that's one of Andre's best matches.
Well, Harley was great at that time. It must be, yeah.
He was great in this match. Probably one of his last best matches. I believe his ankle injury hurt him a lot after in 1981. And, you know, that's the first time that his body began failing on him. So everything before 1981 was probably a lot better than you know, whatever else, except perhaps that match in Puerto Rico that Chris was talking about. But, you know, in the 70s, Andre was still able to have great matches.
Pat, I want to ask you real quick, because I didn't get to the other day. When Andre died, it was a bodybuilding writer, actually, who I knew, who, like, was writing a story on his obituary, and he was like, what if, you know, Andre had gone into, you know, not bodybuilding, but powerlifting, or, you know, maybe Greco-Roman wrestling or judo or something, you know? It's like, what if he had done, like, a real sport? You know, it was one of those great what-ifs, you know, and we never really, there's no way to answer it, because Andre never was a weightlifter guy. But had he been, I mean, look at that frame. I mean, it's just like, when you looked at Andre when I was a kid, it's like, you know, he had to be the strongest man in the world. And even people who knew him said that, like, he never did deadlifts, so to speak, but his ability to, like, lift a car, you know what I mean, which is essentially a, you know, an offshoot of a deadlift, like, he could do stuff that nobody else could do because he had that, you know, leg, butt, hip power that no human could have.
He had a natural strength, especially in his early days, but he was never into sports. You know, he played a little soccer when he was young in his village in France, but, you know, he was never into sports, never into lifting weight. He, even Vince tried to get him access to his gym before WrestleMania 3, and he was trying to make Andre drink some protein shake, and Andre didn't like it because it made him fart too much. So Andre was not the gym rat. He didn't like it. You have to remember that by the mid-80s, Andre didn't have the strength he used to have. And that's because of acromegaly. I mean, I remember a story in The Princess Bride filming that he couldn't even catch Robin Wright when she was, there's a scene where, you know, she's falling from the sky and he catches her. She had to be held by cables because Andre didn't have enough strength in his arms by that time to catch a girl who probably weighed 100 pounds at the time. You know, it's a big what if, you know, but probably when he was younger, probably when he was leaner in the late 60s, he would have been a big star in other sports, or, you know, amateur wrestling or something else. But it never interested him. He was looking, pro wrestling was really the thing that he fell in love with, and he wasn't a big sport guy ever.
Last question: how many beers did Andre drink in one sitting? When I started training in Calgary, I remember Keith Hart told me, "Oh yeah, Andre used to drink three boxes of wine a night, you know, three cases of wine a night." And then he drank 80 beers. He drank 100 beers. He drank 150 beers. Did you ever get a line on what the real number is, Pat? And have you heard anything about that too, Dave?
Well, it's the kind of story that someone will tell you that, oh yeah, I was there in Tampa where, you know, when he drank 115 beers. I was there in Georgia when he drank 118 beers. I was there in Germany when he drank, you know, 100 and so beers. I mean, it seems like my belief is that it must have happened one or twice, and probably more once than twice. But it seems like it's been told so many times that everyone in the business was there that night. You know, it probably happened only one time. But that's the thing with Andre. He could entertain people when he wanted to. It's like those stories where he would order 10 steaks and eat them all. He could do it, and he did it at some occasions, but only when he wanted to show off, only when he wanted to please the crowd. He wasn't eating that much on a regular basis. I was stunned when Jackie McCauley told me that, you know, on a regular day at the ranch, he would be eating yogurt in the middle of the afternoon. I was like, what? Andre ate yogurt? He wasn't always, you know, eating like big steaks and potatoes and all that. He would show up from time to time, but probably we'll never know the real count on that.
Anything to add to that, Dave?
You know, it's like I always figured that, you know, the wrestling story starts at 80, turned to 90, ended up at 133. You know what I mean? But the thing is, I think that Andre's capacity for drinking, because of his size and everything, I mean, I'm sure it was, and he was, and because he drank so much that you build it up, I'm sure he was one of the great drinkers of all time. I think that that's not up for debate, but, you know, I mean, the story of him drinking 133 beers, passing out, and then putting the piano case over him, you know, in the lobby of a hotel. I mean, I suppose that could be true. I mean, I remember hearing it, but like so many of the Andre stories, so that's one of the things I loved about
story,
so much.
That's a story that Pat Patterson told us. So that I can tell you that it really happened.
No, I believe that.
It was better for everyone to just leave Andre on the floor and just put something on him and leave him there, because no one was going to wake him up tonight, you know? So stuff like that happened, you know?
A piano case. Well, guys, it's been great talking to you, like I said, and it's an excellent book, excellent read about one of the most, if not the most, iconic characters in wrestling history. So, guys, stay safe, and thank you so much. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Chris.
I'll talk to you guys soon. Thanks, Dave.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Au revoir.
I did that on purpose. I don't have to miss.
I believe you. So what happens now?
We face each other as God intended. Sportsmanlike. No tricks, no weapons. Skill against skill alone.
You mean you'll put down your rock and I'll put down my sword and we'll try and kill each other like civilized people?
I can kill you now.
Frankly, I think the odds are slightly in your favor at hand fighting.
It's not my fault being the biggest and the strongest. I don't even exercise.